Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Jim Jarmusch.
Oh, good morning. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to be here, and we should all support Museum of the Moving Image because it's such a gift to New York City. So I'm very happy to be here.
Okay. Well, thanks and good night. That's all we needed to hear.
I know. I'm going to Atlantic City.
Okay. Well, I know I've read in researching and getting ready for tonight, I read all these interviews with you where you talk about how you hate to look back at your films and hate to analyze them. So we're in for a very unpleasant night for you, I think.
Oh, you told me we were going to look at the future films.
Okay.
We have clips from my future work.
That's good. Okay. Well, we'll get to that. We're going to start actually with... But before we see the first clip from Permanent Vacation, another thing I wanted to say about in preparing for the program was that there's a few people who mentioned past jobs that you had in New York. We're sort of in your old stomping grounds here. One person is our projectionist who ran the St. Mark's Cinema, where you were an usher.
Ah, yes.
And then there's somebody here from Rafik Film and Video.
Oh, man, yeah.
So could you talk about some of your your early jobs? Like how were you as an usher?
It was not very good because it was the St. Mark's Cinema. It's where there's a Gap store now, and it was like a third-run movie house. I got paid like $2.50 an hour or something. And one time, my boss told me to tell the Hell's Angels that they couldn't smoke, and I said, "Hey, man, for $2.50 an hour, you know, you go tell them. I'm not telling them anything." Or once I shined a flashlight in a corner and saw an oral sex act, so I quickly turned my light out. And then I had the night manager was a Puerto Rican guy named Ike, and we used to, I probably shouldn't tell this, but we used to go in the theater, this was his idea, when it was closed at night, and try to shoot rats with a .22 caliber pistol. And we did that several times. Ike was very excited by that, but I thought it was a little freaky. But so that was one job, yeah.
Okay, then Rafik, were you...
Well, Rafik was an amazing, amazing character. In fact, I bought my film stock for Permanent Vacation from Rafik. He sold things very inexpensively. You didn't ask where they came from. He had lots of film supplies, editing supplies. He had a screening room called the OP Screening Room. And what was the most fantastic was he had Thanksgivings at Rafik's place. And it was incredible because Jack Smith would be there, Harry Smith, Robert Frank, all these amazing people. Jack Smith always, several years in a row, smeared all my food with cranberry sauce because I said, just put a little there. And then he put them everywhere. One time Harry Smith said, "Man, could you go home and get a joint and come back here? Do you live nearby? And don't bring sticks and stems, you know?" And the great Harry Smith. But those Thanksgivings were incredible. Wow. And I did some construction work for Rafik with some other crazy people trying to expand his setup there. And he was like really nurturing, amazing guy. So, yeah, I worked for him for a while.
So, I've read about, you coming to New York from Akron, Ohio, I guess. Okay.
Contain yourself.
And that you went to...
We're Akronites.
Right.
People don't realize. Ah, that's good.
Well, I had heard that you went to Paris and saw many films at the Cinematheque there. But I also read that there was a theater in Akron. Is this true that at midnight would show like weird movies, like Andy Warhol films and B movies? Because maybe that was more of your formative Cinematheque.
It was, in a way. It was. I think it was in the daytime. It was a art film theater, which back then meant like softcore porno type stuff. And then on the weekends they had underground cinema. I think on Saturday nights, or maybe Friday and Saturday nights at midnight, which was amazing. And I got to see Chelsea Girls by Andy Warhol. I got to see films by Stan Brakhage. Also, they used to show those Buster Crabbe serials of Flash Gordon.
Right.
But they showed a kind of really a mishmash of stuff. But it was, you know, cinema for stoners, basically.
Right.
But a lot of interesting things I saw. They'd interject a cartoon and then have a Michael Snow film. And then, you know, so it was pretty amazing for Akron at that time. So it did open up a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. But you when you came to New York, you were studying literature first at Columbia, then went to Paris and then came back and decided to go into film school.
Yeah.
And made Permanent Vacation. We're going to see a clip from that, but that was made during the period at NYU, but it was not exactly a student film, was it?
Well, it was supposed to be a student film, but then I did two things that were maybe not correct. One was I got a scholarship, a fellowship, ironically, a Louis B. Mayer fellowship, who was really a nasty destroyer of cinema. And they sent the money to me rather than to the school. Whoops. So instead of paying my tuition, I paid for my film.
Right.
And then I was told that I owed the school money, and also you weren't allowed to make a film of that length as a thesis project.
That it was like a feature length.
You were supposed to make a 20-minute film or something. Yeah. But I guess I wasn't in class the day they explained that. But I met a lot of amazing people at NYU, Tom DiCillo and Spike Lee and Sarah Driver and a friend of mine, Richard Bowes. So I had some good experiences there. But then I didn't get a degree because I broke those rules and owed the money and stuff. So, but I did make this film, and I made it. I was inspired really by people like Amos Poe and Eric Mitchell, who were making films at the time, really like do-it-yourself, just wanting to make a film and not knowing how to, basically.
It was called the No Wave. I mean, it became known as the No Wave. Super 8 often, right?
Often Super 8, there was a great thing called the New Cinema on St. Mark's Place, where a group of people rented a storefront and projected films there. Vivian Dick, James Nares, Amos, Charlie Ahern. A lot of interesting stuff was going on. So really, Amos and Eric were always saying, when are you going to make your film, Jim? When I was a little younger than them, but sort of following them around, you know, because, man, you guys made a movie, you know. And they were very encouraging, so they kind of really helped me to get my courage up to make a film of my own, which became this.
Okay, so we're going to see part of the opening section of Permanent Vacation. And, of course, all the clips are on DVD tonight. So,
my name is Aloysius Christopher Parker, and if I ever have a son, he'll be Charles Christopher Parker, just like Charlie Parker. But people I know just call me Allie, and this is my story, or part of it. I don't expect it to explain all that much, but what's a story anyway, except one of those connect-the-dots drawings that in the end forms a picture of something? That's really all this is. That's how things work for me. I go from this place, this person, to that place or person. Well, you know, doesn't really make that much difference. I've known all different kinds of people, hung out with them, lived with them, watched them act things out in their own little ways. And to me, it's To me, those people I've known are like a series of rooms. Just like all the places where I've spent time. You walk in for the first time curious about this new room. Lamp, TV, whatever. And then after a while, the newness is gone completely. And then there's this kind of dread, kind of creeping dread. You probably don't even know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I guess the point of all this is that after a while, something tells you, some voice speaks to you, and that's it. Time to split. Go someplace else. People are going to be basically the same. Maybe use some different kind of refrigerator or toilet or something. But this thing tells you, and you have to start the drift. You may not even want to go, but things will inform you. So here I am now in a place where I don't even understand their language. But, you know, strangers are still always just strangers. And the story, this part of the story, well, it's how I got from there to here. Or maybe I should say from here to here.
You never see the guy.
Yeah, I know. Short. I know. We have to. It's on. Actually, they released this along with *Strangeland Paradise* on the Criterion DVD. But yeah, we didn't see Aloysius Parker, who's the character who's narrating, who's interesting character because he's part of this scene of sort of, you know, this New York in the late 70s. Which is all sort of a lot of outsiders living in the village, but he's even an outsider to that scene. Like he listens to 50s rock instead of punk music.
Yeah.
So it's, and he's like, you know, one of the first of many of your characters who just sort of don't quite know where to fit in. They're just looking.
Yeah, I made the film. I wrote it for Chris Parker, the who plays the character Aloysius, and he was a friend of mine. I think I met him. He was like 15 when I met him. And he had a great way to sneak into CBGB's because he knew this back door. He would somehow get in and then open the back door where they used to load things in and then let us in.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very important in that way. But he was very animated in real life, and then when I started making the film, he slowed way down. So it really shook the whole conception I had of the film, but I followed that.
You responded to that because the film has a kind of
quietness. I couldn't manipulate him to do, you know, to be more animated as he was in real life. Richard Hell and the Voidoids wrote a song about him called The Kid with the Replaceable Head, in fact. And he was kind of a fixture, sort of a con man, kid, punk rock. But he knew a lot about music. We're still friends and interesting person. So I wanted to build the film around him, but I was in kind of a shock when I found that his rhythm was going to be very different while we were shooting. So I just adapted to that, and it even affected kind of the rhythm of the filmmaking.
Hmm. And so you were sort of writing it as you went? I mean, what?
Yeah, I had a script of some kind, you know, if you want to call it that. So, yeah. And this apartment that where it ended was John Lurie's apartment at the time. And a funny thing is Jean-Michel Basquiat was a friend of ours, and he used to paint as Samo on the streets back then at night. He used to paint on walls, right? And so he used to crash at our places. And while we were filming that very scene, he was asleep under the camera in a sleeping bag. And when we put the camera on the other side to you know, reverse it, right, we'd just pull him under so he was never, you know, in the shot. So he's actually there but sleeping. So...
Well, we'll get to see John Lurie in the next clip because, of course, the next movie is Strange and Then Paradise, which opened commercially. What happened with Permanification? Did it play festivals? I mean, what was the sort of life of the film?
It got invited to a festival. I'd never really heard of any festivals except Cannes back then.
Right.
And it got invited to a festival in Germany, Mannheim. And then it won a prize there, which was, I don't know, $1,000 or something. For me, a lot of money. And then it was it was accepted to the Berlin Film Festival. They saw it in Mannheim. And when I showed it in Berlin, it was bought by German television for like $12,000, which is what the film cost, basically. So I was very lucky because I owed money to my vicious landlords and stuff. And I got to come home and pay them off and pay off the film eventually.
Great.
So,
okay, well, let's see. This is a scene with, we'll do the next clip, the clip from Strange in Paradise, and it's a scene with John Lurie and Esther Ballant. So did that story also develop kind of as a response to the personalities of the actors? It seems like that's something that you do a lot. You have you're looking at John Lurie and something about his character and his way of being, and you team him up with Richard Edson and Esther Ballant.
Yeah, I mean, we were just making a film among friends of something that we really thought no one would ever see, but we had the chance to make first. The first third of this film was initially a short film. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote the other two sections while I was editing it. But the first third really is a film really by me and John, because John and I came up with the story together. A lot of things we sketched out and John kind of improvised. We both knew Esther, so the idea of working, you know, having her character came from both of us, you know. So we really, John should kind of get more credit than he does for really like co-writing that part of the film and sort of helping me get it together. I mean, I wrote it into a script and I directed it, but John really, was really a little project that he and I just kept playing with and then actually did it. So he was really important in the whole conception of the film.
Do you remember what it was like that interested him about this character? I mean, about like what he was sort of going for?
Well, we were talking a lot about how, you know, this was in 1982, right? Yeah. So we were a little bit fed up with several things, sort of the style of the kind of scene of, you know, red leather pants and stuff and the rock and roll thing. And, And also this new, like, music video thing where...
Fast cuts,
and yeah. That was starting to affect cinema as well, and everything looked like a commercial to us. So we were kind of reacting to certain things aesthetically that we kind of... You know, we wanted to make these guys look like guys that would hang out at the racetrack, but not at Max's Kansas City kind of thing. So, which is where we hung out, kind of. So,
yeah.
I don't know. We were reacting to something, but I'm not real good at, like, analyzing yeah. that. But we were just going from ideas, and we just made this little 30-minute film, and then we were happy with it, so I wrote more while I was cutting it.
You said there was something that I read in an interview with you, and I think it was about this film, but I think it applies to a lot of the movies, where you have characters in films where if you just stop the film at a certain point, the audience wouldn't be like worried about what's going to happen next. You know, like this idea of sort of just being in the present, and you have these characters who don't really worry about what their next move is going to be. Like, what's great about this movie is just they sort of just decide to go to Cleveland, but there's no like great reason.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not worry so much about the next move.
It sounds kind of flippant, but you know, life doesn't really have a plot, so.
Right.
Things just kind of happen.
Yeah.
And my stories tend to be... I forgot that in Permanent Vacation, he says, what's a story anyway, but
right.
to connect the dots that form a picture of something. And that's kind of how I approach scripts as I prepare them. I collect the dots and then, make a picture out of it as I'm, after I've collected them, and that becomes my script, my story. So... But it starts more with characters and with little ideas and
yeah.
little incidents. And I don't know, a few films, I've tried to make a few films that were based completely on things that would be eliminated from a normal plot, like...
the in-between scenes?
Yeah, I made a film, Night on Earth, with taxis, and really that's the kind of thing that you wouldn't have those scenes in the film. Or Coffee and Cigarettes, it's just little incidents of people... taking time out from whatever they're supposed to be doing. So,
and you said before that you were sort of making this for your friends, not thinking beyond about the commercial life of the film. But I remember very well like the sort of scene that this film created because I waited in line at the cinema studio. It was like a surprise hit, and there wasn't really a big independent scene. I mean, this was a good 5 years before Sundance sort of took off, but it was a It was really something. Like, it was really a moment and a phenomenon, this film.
We were surprised. But happy. I'm still doing it, so I got lucky.
So. I realized when I picked the clips, I realized that I, for some reason, gravitated to a lot of eating scenes. So we just saw a dinner scene. We're going to see a dinner scene from Down by Law, which is Roberto Benigni's character preparing a rabbit meal. So... I don't know, you guys are going to get really hungry watching all these clips, but why don't we watch...
I'm not so sure with
this. Right, well, maybe not with this scene, yeah. But let's see the next clip from Down by Law.
Before, she's very kind with the rabbit. She called the rabbit, "Good rabbit, I like this little rabbit too. What the eyes of the rabbit?" Suddenly, the rabbit dead. Very strange mother, my mother. Very strange, yes. My father, no, he's very strong, but with the rabbit, he is afraid. My sister, I have one mother and three sisters, Bruna, Albertina, Anna. I had a picture of my mother in my room of smiling with the rabbit, her hand and the other, so... Sometimes I dream my mother that called me, "Robertino, vieni qua, Robertino. Come on. No, I don't want. Come on. Come on. My neck. I am not rabbit. Yes, you are. My mother. Very strange mother. But I love my mother. Isolina, my father Gigi, and my sister Bruna, Albertina, Anna. My family. And my rabbit. And I love her. To catch, to dream. Right. What is this? What? Jack! 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 You! Come on! Come
course, Marino, very important, and olive oil. But he's good, eh?
It's disgusting, Bob.
Yes.
Bob, it tastes like a tire.
Yeah, I know, it's very good.
Of course, want to ask you about Roberto Benigni, but one thing that just struck me with the last two clips was how you've talked about the importance of Buster Keaton to you as a filmmaker. I mean, obviously, comedy is one of the important elements of your films, but also a sort of similar sensibility of framing from Keaton. Could you talk about
it? Well, Keaton's one of my favorite directors of all time. Just the content of the thing, just kind of human nature. This fragile character, the idea of him not expressing things with his face, the way he filmed things was really elegant in a way, and I don't know, very moving, because he often used very wide frames, shots, so that he was small in the frame and the world around him was stronger than him somehow, bigger than him, and you become very empathetic because of his style, the way he did it. Very opposite of Chaplin, who is a little more always central in his the films he directed, his character. And also Chaplin, who I also love, but Chaplin had the luxury to shoot things over and over. He could perfect a gag and then go shoot it again. Buster Keaton shot almost everything once, and he had broken bones from every film he made from doing his own stunts, and he came from like a vaudeville circuit, and but really as a filmmaker, just something so moving to me. Yeah. Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And there's something I only learned a couple years ago. You probably know this, but Buster Keaton's films, he was called in by the studio in like 1932. They're now making talkies, and they told, I forget which studio executive, which
it was
bastard.
Probably Louis Mayer.
Probably
it
was Louis Mayer. And he said, we're dropping your contract. We might have some roles for you in these talkies. And by the way, your existing films have been destroyed because we needed to extract the silver from the prints. So your films don't exist anymore. And Buster Keaton believed that they were gone completely until the 1950s, when James Mason, oddly enough, bought a house that Buster Keaton lived in the 20s, and he was married to one of the Talmadge sisters, mm-hmm. Who were a lot of drama, I think, and mm-hmm. he was divorced by her in the 20s. His life was kind of upside down. He left that house. I think she kept his house. I don't know. But someone had put prints of all his movies in a screening room in a kind of closet that had been walled over. And James Mason was restoring the screening room, opened that up and found prints of all of Buster Keaton's films. Mm-hmm. So we have them. But Buster Keaton lived thinking they're gone forever. They don't exist. All those things I did. So I found that really...
It's interesting because you actually... You never made the mistake he did, which was signed with Hollywood. I mean, and you kept control of your negative. That's been something that's been really important to you, personally, I know, is actually physically keeping the negatives and keeping control.
Well, I keep ownership of them, and I have copyright control of all my stuff,
yeah.
I'm very stubborn, so... But, you know, it's something I started off demanding that, and then I never go back as a precedent. And because my films aren't that expensive, I'm able to do that. But, you know, I do license them for long periods of time. So mm-hmm. some of the licenses are 20 years or so.
Yeah.
But then eventually the rights all belong to me and the negatives. So.
And could you talk a bit about Benigni, about how you found him? I mean, this was really a film that... launched him for American audiences.
Well, one thing for this scene particularly, he improvised almost all of that. I just had a rough idea to give him about cooking the rabbit and talking about his experience as a child with his mother raising rabbits. But his English was so limited that he was just calling on things, You know, I was shocked when he said, I love my mother. You know, certain things he said, he was just improvising. Those are the real names of his sisters and his parents. He was just trying to pull whatever English he had out. And he made a very, very beautiful scene out of it. Yeah. And we met in Italy because I was the one and only time I was a member of a jury was in a small festival called Salsa Maggiore. And Roberto, a friend of mine, oh, this is a long story. I don't know if it's worth it. I think I've told it before. A friend of mine, Enzo Ungari, an Italian writer, was writing with Bertolucci, the last emperor. And he was a friend, and I had mutual friends, and his wife, Marekka, was Dutch and used to work at the Rotterdam Film Festival. And Enzo died very young, tragically. And so Marekka was working for this film festival, and she called me and said, would you come and be on the jury? And it was a chance to see her and some other friends of mine. And a friend of hers was Roberto Benigni, and he was going to be on the jury. But I didn't know, I had never met him, I knew nothing about him. So we were on this five-member jury with Robert Wise and Alan Tenner, and Roberto and I were the bad kids because the head of the festival would find us when we were supposed to be watching films. He'd find us like out in an alley smoking cigarettes and talking broken French. Because he didn't speak English and I didn't speak Italian, so we spoke in probably infantile French. But we talked endlessly for a week. You know, we couldn't stop talking with each other about everything. So we became very close very fast, and then I went from there to Rome. I had a little treatment I was working on of a story for John Lurie and Tom Waits, but I had something missing that I hadn't found yet. And I found it. It was Roberto. And then I wrote something and then gave it to him, and someone translated it just by reading. And he said, very good. I like for to do this thing with you. You know? So then I went home and wrote the script. And now Roberto remains a very close friend. And I talk to him like at least one Sunday out of every month. And he's coming soon to do his Dante performance in New York.
That's
so
great.
But he is an amazing character. But we had a lot of fun playing jokes on him with his English and all that. But really an amazing person, really a kind of idiot savant in a way, you know, because he's from very rural Tuscany, and yet he has committed to memory like hundreds of pages of Italian poetry. Mm. He's constantly reading philosophy and all kinds of stuff, theoretical physics, and, you know, he's really an amazing character, I think. And he eats like a horse. And he remains so thin. And I think it's because his brain burns it all off. Because his brain is always, as he would say, my brain is on fire. And he's always, man, so much going on in him, always. So he's not what he appears. He's not the clown that he reverts to, like at the Oscars and stuff. But he's a very different person, really. So. Mm. Still very funny, but not that kind of slapstick funny. So, yeah.
Well, so you wound up making three films that have, of your first three commercial films that have...
Are they commercial?
Well...
They were commercially
they might
released.
Not have been blockbuster hits, but they were in theaters. People paid to see them. So Mystery Train was the next one, and that is, of course... Go ahead, you can applaud if you want. And that's... set in Memphis, and you have just keep naming random cities. So anyhow, let's see a scene from this. I don't think it needs much of a setup, because instead of making it to Graceland, this Japanese couple gets a tour of Sun Record Studios. So
why should they have to go up north to record it when I can record it right here? Well, it was right here. spare room. Mr. Phillips recorded the likes of Hal Wolf, Rufus Thomas, Charlie Feathers, the Prisoners, James Cotton, Johnny Cash, Billy Lee Riley, Carl Perkins, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, and of course the king of rock and roll himself, Elvis Presley. In June 1953, this young man just graduated from Heems High School, and he found his way on over to Sun Studio to record a song that he said was for his mom's birthday, but his mom's birthday was months away, so. Anyway, Sam found a song he liked, and he said, and I quote, "That's what I like, that's what I'm looking for, that's more like it, y'all keep playing it." But, well, they were excited. They got a song that was soon played on the radio by DJ Dewey Phillips in the year 1954, probably July 9th or 10th, and he would have to play that song somewhere between 7 and 11 times that night. Well, the switchboard stayed lit up there. People wanted to know if it was white calls for call, black calls for call, but the bottom line was the song was going to be a hit.
なんでか疲れちゃった。グレースランドに行きたくないの行かなくていい?いいよ。いいんじゃないの?でも本当は今日グレースランド行くの楽しみにしてたんだ、俺。あれ?行きたくなかったんじゃなかったっけ?ちょっと歩いてみないか?いいよ。
I just couldn't resist running it to see that movie theater. But also you work with Robbie Mueller here, who also shot the previous film, Down by Law, but you make this move to color, and we get a little bit of a sense of it here. There's a real beautiful control of color, of controlling the elements of the landscape.
Yeah, and we were kind of coding objects in the film in color. It's the red things were specific. But yeah, Robbie Mueller, amazing. I still I'm amazed that I got to collaborate with him on so many films. Some really a gift. One of the great cinematographers for me. So yeah, that was. But I just realized that that scene has more dialogue in it than some of my other films in their entirety. I think. And that actress, Jodie Markell, is from Memphis. And,
oh really?
We're still friends, and she. She I wrote that, but she had to deliver it that fast. You know, it's fun.
Do they do a tour of Sun Records?
I think they do, but it's not like that. It's not. But it was amazing to film in that very room. It was kind of exciting.
And that film has, the structure of three different interweaving stories. Could you talk about sort of coming up with? With that, I think all of your films have this sort of interesting structure to them. In the previous ones, we saw you kind of throwing three interesting characters together and kind of seeing what would happen. And here, and then in the next film, we're going to see you doing these sort of multi-part films.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as some critics think, my films are kind of formless, but I'm very form-oriented, so... Form is very interesting to me and important to me. This film, this film made little references to the Canterbury Tales in that they're on a journey to, they're on a kind of quest. And also things like the, and which is interlocking stories, which reminded me of train cars, hence the title, and trains in the film. These three stories happen simultaneously, but we jump back and start from the beginning of each one. So I was thinking also of I love the Decameron, Boccaccio, where it's people just telling stories and them being linked together to make something out of it. So, yeah, I was interested in the form for sure. A lot of the street signs are names of poets and make some reference to those things. She even says Chaucer Street at one point, you know. Which in New Orleans, in Memphis, there are a lot of streets named after poets, too, which I thought was kind of cool. But, yeah, I don't know. Where were we?
And you've got right here. And you've got, of course, Bernini.
Wish I was here.
Bernini reciting poetry, Down by Law reciting Robert Frost, or Bob Frost, as he calls
him. Yes, and Walt Whitman, yeah. And Bob Frost.
And then Night on Earth, you came up with this sort of interesting formal structure of basically having this situation that repeats five times with variations of cab rides around the world.
Yeah, another important word for me is variations, because I love variations, and I love how they're used in everything, in architecture and pop music and classical music and fashion and... You know, the idea of variations, of endless variations, is something much more valuable than the idea of an original story to me. So I love variations of things. And Night on Earth is also simultaneous, but five stories in five different cities that happen at the same time. And again, incidental moments that you would probably leave out of another film.
So we're going to see, the one we're going to see a clip from is the New York one with Rosie Perez. And a lot of dialogue in this. Not. She's being pushed into a cab by Giancarlo Esposito.
What are you doing?
I think that you'd said that you originally thought this was going to be sort of a real easy thing, you know, just car, you know, just shooting in cars, very, very simple setup, and it would be like sort of easy to film, but you found maybe.
Yeah, I was preparing another film, and it spent a lot of time on it, and then it wasn't happening, and then I got very frustrated, so I wrote this script in about 9 days, and what I really just wanted to do was think of actors that I knew or wanted to work with and wrote for them. So then I thought, well, I wrote it so fast and it's all in cars and it'll be easy to shoot, but it was very difficult to shoot. And shooting in cars all the time and moving to three cities in five cities in four countries with different crews in each one except for our main crew. Was very complicated and exhausting. But I made a miscalculation, I guess. But it was still fun to make, and I got to work with a lot of amazing people that I wrote it for, you know, friends of mine in Finland and in Paris and Roberto, again, in Italy. So and these guys who were wonderful. So it was fun, but difficult.
And the idea of personality, of sort of looking at personality and letting, using cinema to reveal personality instead of being sort of stuck in telling a story seems so central to what you do. Is that something that you got, came partly out of looking at Hollywood movies, looking at directors like Nick Ray or Howard Hawks, the directors who, you know, capture so much of the personality of the actors in their work?
Yeah, and I just like when characters drive the thing, your interest in it as a story. And I also like actors that are reacting and not acting out the meaning of something. So, yeah, I'm very attracted to characters sort of first. I usually start with a character or a certain actor that I'm imagining as a type of character, and then start collecting other ideas around that. So they remain central for me somehow.
Yeah. Okay. I think there's a real sort of advance in Dead Man. There's so much in the film. I think you. We'll talk about it a bit after. We're going to see a clip with Johnny Depp and Robert Mitchum. You got the amazing Robert Mitchum to work with.
Yeah, his last film.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what we'll do is we'll watch the clip first. This is just an encounter. I think they're sort of one scene together, these characters. Johnny Depp is William, plays a character named William Blake.
Is John Hurt in this too?
Yeah, we do see him at the beginning.
One of my favorite actors.
I insist on speaking to Mr. Dickinson.
You insist?
I insist.
Well, Dickinson, I'm afraid you insist.
Yes, I do.
And right there's the door.
All right, then.
Go on, then!
Well, I will.
Well, I like how they have to open the magic door each time.
This is such a multi-layered film. Even the scene we just saw, which has a sort of dreamlike quality to it, you're sort of reinventing the Western. There are sort of magical moments in the film, sort of surreal moments. And the film explores so many different things. I know you said you don't like to analyze your films, but you're obviously exploring American history, exploring different cultures. We didn't include the Native American character who befriends Blake.
Yeah, played by Gary Farmer. Yeah. Another amazing person.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm curious sort of about the combination of your, you know, what your ambitions were for the film and what you were exploring. And then I guess we can get into the whole story about what happened to the film.
You know, the films I made before this I considered, like, genreless, or they would be very difficult to assign a genre to them. And this film, I wanted to use the genre of a Western because it's so laden with metaphors and such a great kind of frame in which you can express so many things, especially often about America and as a place and as a, you know, as a country. So, yeah, I tried to make a film where I could have more layers in it. I could make it even more referential and hopefully let you follow it on the surface without really paying all that much attention to those things, but trying to get a lot of them in there. So it was a kind of departure for me that it was also a very difficult film to make because we couldn't raise the money that it required because they said they wanted, you know, people putting money in said, if you make it in color, we'll give you the extra $2 million that you need or whatever. But I refused. So we were traveling around in trucks with horses and period wardrobe and shooting in locations where you can't see a road or a telephone pole or, you know. So it was another really difficult one to make, but I'm very proud of it because we did what we wanted and we pulled it off. So,
and Miramax sort of was famously kind of resistant or dismissive. I don't know what the right word is, but they didn't boost the film very much.
Well, Miramax bought the film after it was completed, and then immediately asked to have producers' titles on it and a re-edit on it, and I was like, Manny, you know, you signed a contract, which, anyway, I won't go into all of that, but so in the end, Jay Hoberman said the film was released with tongs, which is kind of how it was released. I had a funny thing happen, like, a few years after the film came out, two, like, skateboard kids were following me on the street, like, wait, stop, man, you're Jim, right? I'm like, yeah. You made that film, Dead Man? And I said, yes. They said, that is our favorite film of all time. We've seen it, like, 12 times, but only on, you know, video, because I think we were out of town the 2 days it showed in the theater. And they were laughing. I said, yeah. Thanks, I guess.
But, well, I mentioned, I mentioned the retrospective that we did at the museum in 1997, and it was because of Dead Man that we wanted to do that, and Miramax said, no, I don't think this is the one you want to do a retrospective with, and then, so we showed Year of the Horse instead.
So nice to feel supported.
Right.
But you know, the thing is, I'm not bitter about Miramax's releasing it with tongs, because the film, I knew, I mean, it's, what is it? It's a psychedelic, black and white, slow-moving Western that veers into I don't know what. So it was, just because it has Johnny Depp, it doesn't assure it's going to be a blockbuster. So I was not expecting it to be a commercial hit. I would have appreciated a little more support.
Right.
I mean, we had a premiere for the film at the Miramax screening room, which is about one-eighth of this size. And they had two screenings and a little cocktail thing in between. And I said to Harvey Weinstein, you know, this is really not a premiere, Harvey. I mean, this is all we get. And he said, wise up, you know, get used to it. This isn't a premiere. This is a photo op. So get over there with Allen Ginsberg and get your picture taken. So, whoa. Anyway, that was our premiere.
Okay.
I was given a piece of cheese and a glass of water.
Well, you could have had it in Astoria. But
yeah, but thanks to you, we were shown the next year in a beautiful way, but it was released, but
one of the things that the film does do, you talked about the type of movie it is, but it explores ideas of transcendence and spiritualism and sort of ways of living that you start to explore more and more in film. So this is kind of a segue into the next film that we're going to look at, which is Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. So why don't we just look at a clip? This is the big shootout scene. You know, films don't have a lot of big shootout, action-packed scenes. So this is, we're just going to jump right to this with Forrest Whitaker.
One has made a decision to kill a person, even if it will be very difficult to succeed by advancing straight ahead, it will not do to think about going at it a long roundabout way. The way of the samurai is one of immediacy, and it is best to dash in headlong.
Hello, I'm Bob Solo. I'm with Westside Realty. I have an appointment with Mr. Vago.
How the hell did you get in the gate, Mr. Solo?
Oh, Mr. Valerio, you gave me the code. But this is a very important meeting, and I may have a buyer for the estate.
You know what? Go inside, Sammy, and check this out. I'll stay here with a Mr. Solo.
You mind if I get out and stretch my legs for a second?
No, you stay in the car, Mr. Solo.
Hey, why don't I give you my card?
I've been expecting you.
You again? You borrowed my book?
You know, I think you're responding to a few things. One is this this book about the sort of way of the samurai that describes this, almost Zen approach to life, but the samurais are warriors. And you're responding to something in Forrest Whitaker, who can sort of project these opposing qualities of of violence and control and rage and serenity at the same time. We saw that in Last King of Scotland, of course, that other side of him. Could you talk about...
Well, I love those qualities of Forrest, and I love how he's just so, empathetic and human, you know? He's something very... I've just always loved his presence on screen. Whoever he's playing, unless it's Edie, I mean, but, something goes out from your heart, and even what he did with that was very complex, so... It was really great to work with him. And we had the great Henry Silva in that scene who gets shot from, known in The Manchurian Candidate, Johnny Cool, other films, but I've always been a fan of him, so I was lucky to have him in the film. Again, shot by Robbie Mueller. It was a film that I kind of collaged a lot of things together while creating it.
And also responding to the structure of the book. You have you separate scenes with these sort of aphorisms and.
Yes, they're from a book called the Hagakure, which was the code of the samurai, which is really a philosophical book of preparation as a warrior. So I have that in there. I have, you know, hip-hop. RZA did the score for the film from the Wu-Tang Clan. There's some Eastern, obviously Eastern philosophy in the Hagakure. And then there's this kind of washed out gangsters that are kind of past their place in history that are kind of whimsical in a way. And one thing I wanted to say, though, because I tend to say often that, well, I write for certain actors and then I have them in my film. But for central actors, that's the case. But I have to talk about Ellen Lewis, who I work with, a casting director. And I've worked with her since Dead Man. She works with Marty Scorsese, so I have to get her when I can, but she is amazing. So she helps me find the right actors for those people I haven't written for specifically. And we've worked all these years together, and she is really something very important to me as a collaborator. So sometimes it just seems like, yeah, I just write for them and here they come, you know. But I got to say, Ellen Lewis is like my collaborator on the casts. So.
Okay. And, well, actually, we have three more clips and they all feature Bill Murray, who, there's one without Bill Murray. But the next clip we're going to see is from Broken Flowers. So why don't we look at that and then we'll talk about him.
Wait, hold on, my son is ringing. Hello? I know, I just talked to her. That's crazy, right? I know. Can I help you with something? Donnie, is that you?
Hey, Laura.
What are you doing here? We're having chicken for dinner.
That was quite an outfit you were wearing earlier.
Well, here we are. Then, Larry exploded in a ball of flames at the traffic. That happened. And now it's just me and Lo.
Hey, it was even on TV.
I'm sorry.
Well, your head looks just like a pineapple.
Mom.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it does look like a pineapple. So what, where do you work?
Oh, Mom has her own business, right?
Really?
I'm a professional closet organizer. I organize people's closets. I even do their drawers. I label everything. I get them all organized. I even color coordinate them.
Yeah, and they pay her for that. It's amazing.
Lolita. I said you... Lolita. I said you could have a taste. Now, come on, listen up to that. That's not cool.
Lolita. Interesting choice of name, Mark.
What?
Well, I mean, you achieve a tone in this film. There's a line in Down by Law that Roberto Benigni's character says that he sort of goes around spouting, it's a sad and beautiful world. And the sort of combination of comedy and poignance, you really capture that. A lot of it, of course, you found an actor who can really express that. But I don't know if you could talk, I guess, about either how Bill Murray brings that quality and then how you sort of set the tone, created that tone.
Oh, man. I just, you know, I wrote this one for Bill. I really wanted to have him, to work with him on a character that was very low-key, sort of underplayed. I thought he would improvise a bit more, but he decided he liked the script and didn't really improvise. Mm-hmm. We didn't rehearse anything. We just walked around a lot, talking for hours, taking long walks, sort of around the character. And that was what we needed to find the character. But we didn't rehearse scenes specifically.
Yeah.
But he did stick pretty close to the script I'd written. But I just think his range is amazing. And, you know, actors get thought of for certain things. It's always sort of, for me, I don't know, strange. It's similar for me with Sharon Stone. You know, people have a certain image of Sharon Stone. But she's really a lovely actor. When I saw her in Casino, I just thought, man, she is amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And yet they usually sort of typecast certain people for certain things, and I try not to get stuck with those things. But Bill, now we've done three things together, and I just really love... I've seen him also, his procedure change.
Hmm.
Like the new film, The Limits of Control, he actually wanted to rehearse the scene, and he did not want to change any word of dialogue at all. Although the dialogue's so limited in The Limits of Control that it's very precise, so there wasn't that same room, although if he had had ideas, I would have wanted to play with them. But I just really love his reactiveness, you know?
So before we get to Limits of Control, we get to see a bit of the sort of lunatic side of Bill Murray, I guess, in this next clip, because we're going to see a little bit of coffee and cigarettes. So why don't we show that clip? Which was, a series of short films that you made over the years that was turned into the feature.
Yeah, he's with RZA and GZA from Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
Anybody need more coffee?
Just between us. And you guys are, related.
Hey, you cousins, we family, bro.
No, you're messing with me now because you're both troublemakers.
Troublemakers?
The Wu-Tang Clan.
Right, Wu-Tang Clan.
You're a GZA. the genius.
That's right.
And you're RZA,
aka
Bobby Digital.
Yeah, you know it's hip hop, yo. You know it's hip hop. And you're Bill Murray. Bill Groundhog Day Ghost Busting Ass Murray.
You know all that. That's gonna kill you.
So what you gonna tell nobody, Bill Murray? I mean, people gonna come here, they gonna see you. You're Bill Murray, it's obvious.
Unless you're wearing a disguise or something.
Though I am wearing a disguise.
Damn, that's harsh, money. You're a real caffeine junkie, aren't you?
Just keep it down, just keep it down.
You know, before I gave that up, I used to drink it every night, every single night, up until it was time to go to sleep, just to make me dream faster. You know, like when they flash those cameras on those MD500 cars, and they just... That's how my dreams were, just whizzing by.
You stupid, yo. You're stupid, isn't it?
I know a guy. Freeze his coffee. Put sticks in it. Has himself a coffee popsicle. Calf pop.
A calf pop.
Damn. That don't sound too good, Bill Murray.
It's not fluid. Mother's coffee.
That's what I'm trying to tell you, man. Nicotine, man. Nicotine interferes with the central nervous system, the respiratory system. I mean, in very small doses, it causes paralysis.
You know, whenever I talk to Bill Murray, I still always call him Bill Murray. Always. Like, hey, Bill Murray. I call him on the phone. Hey, Bill Murray.
Like Bob Dahl, too.
Yeah. Bob Dahl. But I don't talk to him.
You don't?
I don't know him.
He probably would be good, actually. He's got a sense of humor. You could
maybe.
Yeah. But
maybe with Bill Murray.
Yeah. Did you... again, this is sort of variations on a theme, because each of the coffee and cigarette films is a coffee. It sort of ends with an overhead shot, but you have the different actors. And did the actors, you know, what was the collaboration with the actors on these?
Well, I really wanted to encourage, I had scripts for them, but I wanted to encourage improvisation as much as I could. I thought of these as kind of like cartoons, you know, and a lot of the dialogue repeats from other ones, like two of the jokes in this about drinking coffee before you go to sleep so your dreams can whiz by are from Stephen Wright in an earlier one. Right. And also Stephen Wright made up the thing about, I like to freeze them and make, you know, coffee popsicles. Yeah. But a lot of the dialogue repeats throughout different ones. Not the same dialogue, but anyway, it's again about variations for me. So, and the actors were playing themselves. I mean, not really, but they were making fun of themselves, which is a lot of fun, and they have a lot of fun doing that. So. Yeah. There's one with Alfred Molina and Steve Coogan where they really make fun of themselves as actors. And so they were a lot of fun, and Bill was great. We didn't even know. This is the first thing I did with Bill, and he told me several days before, he said, just call me the night before, leave the location and time on my answering machine, which I did, but I had no idea if he'd even show up, you know? But he was there right at that time. So parked his own car, you know, drove in. So he was there.
Well, we're not going to make it to the future tonight, but we arrived at the present with your new film, Limits of Control.
Hey, that's all you can expect, is to arrive at the present.
So, well, I've seen the film. I can't wait to see it again. It's an amazing movie. And it's first of all, stars an actor who you've worked with a few times. So it, I guess raises, it feels like a film where you must have had this actor in mind or certain qualities about him.
Yes, Isaac de Bankole I worked with four times. We've been friends for 20 years, and he's a close friend, but there's something about, I always, over for at least 15 years, had in the back of my head that someday I'm going to make a film with Izak where he is a very quiet, very controlled, very cool kind of criminal that can't be swayed from his mission. And I'm going to center a film around him where he's very, he doesn't speak much. And so this finally is a result. But I've been kind of fermenting this thing for quite a long time for him. So kind of, he was the beginning of this idea.
Yeah. Well, so let's, we have two clips to look at. To give you a flavor of it, we'll watch the first one, which is another coffee scene. So, but this, and this film is all shot in Spain, and the landscape is, yeah.
¿Usted no habla español, papá?
No.
Hola. ¿La señorita va a querer tomar algo?
Agua sin gas, por favor.
El agua. Bueno, la bella señorita.
Gracias. Suspicion. Hitchcock. Are you interested in films by any chance?
Well, I mean, one thing, there's a lot of different things to say about this film. One thing to say, which doesn't totally come through in the clip, is the amazing use of color in this film. It's just a stunningly expressive film and carefully worked out in color. And it's a remarkable collaboration. You work with the cinematographer Christopher Doyle. And I really felt like you were sort of bringing out the best in each other. Like I'm sure had a reason for picking him, but this is not like, really not like his other films. It feels like you kind of gained from each other, working with each other.
Well, yeah, I've known him for a long time, 12 years or so, and we always planned to do something together. We made one music video together for the Rock on Tours, Jack White's band, the first video, which we shot mostly on little toy video cameras. But, you know, people keep saying to me, well, it's so different than Chris Doyle's other work. But, you know, he's very varied. People tend to assign to him this, like, master of handheld from the Wong Kar Wai films. But he's done, you know, he made a remake of Psycho with Gus Van Sant, which was very carefully framed. And his work with, like, Philip Noyce is quite different than what he's done with
And of course, In the Mood for Love is different than the other Wong Kar-wai films.
Yes, so he's really quite variable, actually. And for me, but just to go back, the Broken Flowers was shot by Frederick Elms, as was Night on Earth, who's another amazing cinematographer. So I've been so lucky. But Chris is a really kind of, he's someone that has so many ideas going by, like he's a river full of fish, and they just don't stop, and you can take out the ones you want and work with those, and he has no ego about which ones you choose because he's got more and more coming. So you kind of have to temper what you pull from him because there's too much coming in a way. Not too much, but there's more than enough, like way more. So, but if you pull out, you know, if 30 fish go by and you take out two and say, I like these two fish, he'll say, you do? fantastic. Let's do something with those fish. You know, I mean, he's not like, what about the other ideas? You know, yeah. And his ideas, he's very of the moment, which is very important for the making of this film, because this film was made with a 25-page short story that I wrote. And I said, I'm not going to write a conventional script. I'm going to start with this and work on it as we make the film.
Because,
because it's about intuitive. It needed that intuitive way of finding itself as we went. It needed to grow. It's the nature of the film. If you see it, maybe that'll be more clear. It's also, again, I don't like referring, like comparing my films, but it's, to me, in a way related in certain way to Dead Man, where I got a lot of layers of different themes into it. And this film has a lot of little interconnective things all through it that you don't have to find, but you can find them. It's like a treasure hunt if you're open to them. But you can also just let the surface go without necessarily clocking in all those things. But it's very laden with references and little things for my own amusement, I guess. I don't know. But the whole film's built that way on intuition. So Chris was very important. Chris, he doesn't think about how shots necessarily might cut together, which I have to be careful with him. But man, every shot is beautiful, and every camera position he finds is something very, very strong. And then it's up to me to guide those so they fit together. And, you know, I always collaborate very closely with the DP. Yeah. So, but working with him was kind of an important thing for me to kind of, I don't know, open me a little bit, especially to that following your intuition and keeping your antenna up constantly, you know. And so he was a real important part of this film. I'm proud one of our producers is here too, Gretchen McGowan, who produced this film. We shot it all in Spain. And so I'm proud she's here. But, you know, Chris is someone that really isn't a cinematographer in his mind. He makes collages, paintings, collages made of photographic things, and he makes books of them. Hopefully he'll have more and more shows of them. I hope we put a collection of them on our DVD that he made while we were making this film. Mm-hmm. He calls them from the film but not of the film, or of the film but not from. I don't know where he gets the energy to. This film was very hard to shoot with a very short schedule, and Chris, during the shoot, made about 50 collages. I don't know when the hell he was doing that, but and they're really exquisite and they're beautiful. So I think he thinks of himself not really as a DP in a way, although he's very totally knowledgeable of all the, even the technical aspects of it, but those are not what guide him, you know. So it was an important collaboration, sometimes a difficult one, because he's crazy. Because he's wild, you know. I think Keith Richards met him and said, he's the Keith Richards of cinematographers.
But I would say, no,
Keith Richards is the Christopher Doyle of rock and roll, you know, because he's really...
Well, certainly when you see him in person, he's like a maniac, so that's why I was sort of curious about...
That's what attracted me to him as a friend a long time ago, that he's a maniac, you know. Yeah. And full of ideas, and we interconnect in a lot of places. So, really important part of this film.
But there's such control in the film. You're responding to the landscape. I'm sure that's one reason why you had this intuitive process, because it's very much about the landscape as you go through Spain and the buildings and architecture.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, it's not a travel. It's not a film where you see touristic things of Spain.
Right.
But we wanted to capture. We shot in Madrid, which is very cosmopolitan. We shot in one of my favorite cities on this planet, Seville, Sevilla, and then we shot outside of Almeria in the south, in the mountains. And Almeria is where all the spaghetti westerns were shot, and a lot of big epic films from Hollywood, King of Kings, that kind of stuff. So it's a kind of strangely familiar landscape through cinema for me. So, and the film kind of becomes like a Western in a way. Well, I don't know. But anyway, so Spain was important to us, but not in a way the film could have been made in Turkey or Mexico or, you know, but Spain kept pulling me when I was writing the little story. So things that I knew in Spain ended up in the film and pulled me to write it for being in Spain.
But you seem to like this idea of places that are not so specific. Like Ghost Dog, you can't tell exactly where it's set. And certainly A Stranger Than Paradise, you create a city that doesn't quite feel like
And when we were filming Broken Flowers, people would ask us, the people on the crew, where does it take place? And we would say, Generica. You know, because you don't know where it is in Broken Flowers. It's just kind of suburban America.
Yeah.
So.
We have one more scene, which is towards the end of the film. You'll figure out right away that some words that are cleaned up a little bit. Not blipped out, but this is somewhat.
They're censored.
Well,
this is because these clips were prepared to give to, like,
for
TV.
Yeah.
These Spanish. Jesus Christ. Addison! The soundproof door. How did you get in here?
I used my imagination.
Okay. Well,
yeah, he's not a funny character. People expect, they see Bill Murray and they start laughing because it's, you know, Bill ghost busting ass Groundhog Day, you know. But in this, he's very, he's not, there's nothing funny in his performance at all. Which was really interesting for me to you know, that was an intention.
Yeah. And
which he's done before, like Mad Dog and Glory had a very complicated kind of nasty character that wanted to be a comedian but wasn't funny, you know.
Somehow we haven't talked much about music tonight, so I just want to give a chance because we were the entrance music that we had on in the beginning was music that you composed and played. And then there's music by this incredible Japanese group.
Boris.
Boris. Yeah. So I guess if you could talk specifically about the music in this film, it's really extraordinary.
Well, I always start, you know, music is always one of my first things of inspiration. And when I find music that seems to trigger something that is opening my imagination for the story or the film, the atmosphere, the thing I'm trying to, in the initial stage, is right. That music becomes very, very important to me, and I don't. It usually ends up in the film, or some element of it. For example, when I was writing Dead Man, I was listening to a lot of Crazy Horse and the more instrumental sections of their stuff. When I was writing Ghost Dog, I was listening to the RZA's instrumental mixes on the B-side of DJ Vinyl that I was collecting. In this film, I was listening to Boris and the band Sun, and they end up being very important in the film. But I knew I wanted that kind of slow, heavy, psychedelic stuff that I find in those bands, Sun and Boris and Earth and there's a little piece from a band I love, the Black Angels. So that music became a kind of formative or inspirational for me.
And there's actually two separate CDs coming out.
Yeah, well, then we couldn't find, we had trouble finding music that to use for certain parts in the film when he goes to museums mostly. And so our band, and Carter Logan is here, is the other, there's three of us in our band. So we'd made some music for this, for the film, some instrumental tracks that are going to come out on a little EP at the same time as the soundtrack record. And we're working on a record also now, our own album. So, but the music in the film, there are three elements in this film, that kind of genre of rock and roll. I don't know. People call it a lot of different things.
Right.
And then some flamenco stuff that is all primarily a certain form of flamenco that I only discovered while researching ideas about the film, called petanera, which is a kind, almost like the blues of flamenco. It's slow, and the dancing is very gestural with hands, more than like the stomping feet type of style. And then there's Schubert's, the adagio from Schubert's string quintet that is extremely beautiful, that is woven through the film in places. So it has three very diverse kind of things, but they all are woven into the film.
The films always sort of combine different elements, and one thing I really like about them is that you, this is a real film lover's movie. I mean, as you watch it, there are sort of echoes of Jacques Rivette and the sort of, you know, conspiracy that you can never quite figure out, and certainly Antonioni and the landscape, and those sort of specific film references. But you don't seem like somebody who like feels like you have to separate film and life. Like, I like the fact that art and poetry and books and films are just part of the fabric of the of how you see the world. It's not like a separate thing.
Yeah, to me, it's all, inspirations come from so many places. I mean, I was writing, for some reason I couldn't sleep a few nights ago, I was writing a little list of things I love, and I can't remember, it was kind of a long list, but it was things like wood, and the texture of wood, the color of copper, bikinis on a female form, the paintings on low riders of like sexy girls or Jesus, you know, the different colors of different, the variations of skin tones of people on this planet. Once, man, I was on the subway, I saw a guy that was gray. I mean, almost blue. And I think he was Moroccan from a certain place where their skin tone is blue-gray, you know? Or one time, like a year ago, I started almost tripping by looking at paint chips that you get. And I went to a store and I collected all the different colors of white that they had. And I laid them out on a table, and man, it was like hallucinatory because, no, it was so beautiful, the subtle variations of, well, this one has a touch of pink and that a touch of gold and that blue and that gray. But if you held any one up, it's just white, you know? So I don't know. But inspiration to me comes from anything that is striking or moving, and it could be a minor little detail of something, or from, you know, I love books and music and movies and paintings and all that stuff, but I also love just random things that might strike you by their form or their color or their smell, or I don't know. So, and I draw on all those things to try to make something out of them when I try to make something. So.
Okay, well, so maybe we have arrived at the future, because this list will somehow wind up as your next film.
So. I doubt it, but you know, I could make a list like this. It might be a good exercise to try to make a new one every day, you know, because I find it very strange when people say they're bored, and I just don't, I mean, I understand boredom, but there's so many things in the world that are so striking and strange and beautiful that to be bored is kind of strange to me in a way. Like, I like to wake up and think about all the movies I haven't seen that exist, or books I don't know about, or I don't know, it just seems like, man, or different species on the planet, all these things. that it just amazes me that you'll never have enough time to absorb them.
And it seems like you've, like, in a way, as you talk about that, it just seems like this is what so many of your characters do, is sort of find, in very different ways, like find ways to just sort of be in the moment, whether it's eating a TV dinner or the character in Limits of Control, who, you know, seems to be just, you know, he's got a mission to do, but he seems to just want to exist and take in what's around him.
Were there things in the Limits of Control that struck you as funny or amusing as well? Because I don't know.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I try to start out making something serious, but the always funny stuff comes in. I can't stop myself. One of my favorite quotes in the world is Oscar Wilde said, "Life is far too important to be taken seriously." But still, even when, like Dead Man, I thought was going to be a really austere, heavy thing, but I couldn't stop funny things in it, you know. So it's just my nature, I guess.
Certainly in the Paz de la Huerta character, I mean, there's a comic element to that.
Yeah, I think there are funny things throughout. Not like Bill Murray drinking out of a coffee.
No. You know?
But anyway.
But you don't need to put a laugh track on it. I think it'll...
Yeah. That would be a little strange.
But it's
although if Miramax released it, it might be so inclined. I don't know.
Well, it's a great film. Do you feel satisfied with it, or do you not think that way?
I feel very happy because we were able to make the film the way we wanted to make it. Well, basically, schedule-wise, not really. But in terms of all the content and the collaborations are all totally... We had total control over them, so we made the film we wanted to make, and Focus Features financed the film and just totally respected that, like left me and the whole film basically alone, you know? So there was no interference, so I'm very proud that we made a strange film, and it's going to come out in theaters next week.
Okay.
So I'm very happy.
Okay. Well... Thanks so much for sharing this with us. It's been amazing.
Thanks for having me, and thank you guys for coming. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.